It's time for the podcast that redefines leadership for those that are seeking the truth on leadership. It's showtime with Asus Kampa, an internationally recognized expert on leadership, retired police chief, and CEO, who brings you groundbreaking interviews with the leaders of today who are changing the game to favor true leaders of vision as they lead through adversity and share their stories of adversity on the Leading Through Adversity LTA podcast. Here is your host, Asus Kampa, CEO of Leading Through Adversity.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Leading Through Adversity with your host, Jesus Kampa. Like always, I'm excited to bring you a new show with a very exciting guest. You're right. This is the second part of Season 2 coming to you from the Leading Through Adversity Studios in Texas. We are excited to have had a wonderful conversation with Ash Gelb, an educator who has been through a lot of adversity, spent a lot of time in the classroom, and she saw a problem and she found a way to fix it. So I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you and developing a friendship and a bond with Ash. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoy this interview with Ash Gelb in 1, 2, 3. Let's do it. Welcome back to another episode of Leading Through Adversity. Like always, I'm your host, Jesus Kampa, owner and CEO of Leading Through Adversity. Today, we're blessed to have a special guest all the way from Denver, Colorado, Ash Gelb.
Can I say that right?
Yeah. Ash, yes. All right. Ash, so you are an educator by trade.
Yep.
And what I'm going to do is while I can blab and blab about all your credentials in the education field and how frustrating you got with education, I'd just rather have them hear it from your side. So Ash, this is nothing that's uncommon. My wife's an educator, so I know how frustrating it is. I'm an adjunct professor, so I know how frustrating that is. So Ash, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found yourself where you're at now by leading through adversity?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Eddie. So I've been an educator for the last 7 years in Denver, Colorado, and I've worked mostly in Title I schools. And the way I found myself there was really because I did not like school. I did not have the best educational experience. And I realized that I wanted more for today's youth, and that's why I became an educator. But as I was growing up, I grew up in the Denver area as well. I was diagnosed as being twice exceptional when I was in an elementary school, which means I had a learning disability and also was gifted and talented. Mm. And the school system didn't really know what to do with that. And so I was pulled into like the resource room, right? The kids that you see that the sped kid, right? Like all of that. And I experienced a lot of that stigma, and very much the deficit of what I was experiencing was seen, but not the assets. And through education and through being in the education field, I have seen that that was not a unique experience to me, right? We see that a lot with our youth of color. We see it a lot with our diverse learners, our English language learners, that we kind of umbrella as the L's in my field because they're the exceptional learners. And that is what brought me into just having this deep passion to ensure that equity is being sought out and is the ultimate outcome of our education system.
Right, awesome. Yeah, I can totally relate to what you're saying. My wife, like I said, is an educator. Her entire career has been spent in Title I schools. She is now an administrator. She oversees federal programs and specialized ESL programs and stuff like that. So I hear the frustration. Being a law enforcement officer, when I started my career, a few years into it, I was a school resource officer, and then we were in Title I schools out in the county, and having to see the diversity and the inequality of treatment for the different sections, special ed students, ESL students, even the equality of social economics, there's a big disparity there. So I really don't want to blame the educators because it's not really their fault. They're in a system, the education system, which is kind of broken and has been broken for a very long time. So my hat's off to you for seeing that there was an issue and breaking away from that. So when you notice this issue and a need for specialized training and a specialized type of education, I mean, how did you put all that together?
I think so. Obviously, I have formal education, and that is rare for somebody with my background. Oftentimes, twice exceptional kids don't finish college, and it's a very windy road to get to that point. So I have some formal education, but the reality is, I think the lived experience, right? We study a lot in theory. You talked about you're doing your PhD program right now. You're an adjunct professor, but it really is being in the classroom, connecting with youth, connecting with families, that I would say has given me the most practical understanding of how to implement theory. Your background as a police officer, right? We can study things in a classroom. We can talk about how to do a hold or how to de-escalate a situation, or, you know, like what you would do. But when you get into the real world and when you get into the physical environment, that's when you really see your underlying beliefs. That's when you really come to surface what you're hardwired to do. And I think through self-reflection and then intentionality, crafting ways to reimagine education and to relook at what's possible. And I'm now an admin, and I deeply appreciate the work that your wife is doing. But I think a lot of our teachers think they have to get out of the classroom in order to do this. And I think there's deep power and impact that you can have on the 30 young people that are sitting in front of you every day when you stay in the classroom as well. And I want our teachers to be able to see that.
So tell us a little bit more of your while you spend time in the classroom educating stuff. Right now, you're listed as an educational equality coach. Can you tell us exactly what is that? What does that entail, and what do you do with that?
Yeah, so as an educational equity coach, what I currently do is I build team capacity. I build teacher capacity on campuses to foster equity teams that then do liberatory design work. So they work in partnership with their community. They source, these are the challenges that we're experiencing. These are solutions that our community would like to attempt. And they work towards systems change as a team. And so it's partnering the individual mindsets with policy change.
That's a good way to look at it. So, you know, you talk about supporting teachers to infuse diversity, inclusion, and equality. And then earlier, when I first opened up the show, I talked about the adversity that the education system is in, and I referred to it as a broken system. Yeah. However, I've done the same thing with law enforcement. I've always said that the criminal justice system is broken. Yeah. But as I'm speaking to you, and something I just reflecting, something just came to mind, is the are both systems broken? Or were they just designed that way and they haven't been updated?
That's powerful. And I think that's exactly what we're experiencing. I can speak less to the criminal justice system. That is not my area of expertise. I think you could speak to that more. But certainly in education, it was designed around young, white, wealthy men receiving a very particular kind of educational outcome. And we've not done a lot of revision for in the last 350 years since that system was created. And there are now a lot of competing interests in what education outcomes are. And a lot of times those interests are not our families. They're not necessarily our youth. They're private industry. And I could talk about that for a very long time, but I think the biggest thing is recentering, right? Who is our priority in the education system? Who is really the person that we want to be supporting? As a police officer, I am sure that you had that experience as well, right? Like your purpose is not necessarily to like serve a politician, but to serve your community, right? The people that are in front of you. A lot of police officers are doing the work of social workers on our street corners with our community members, because that's the resource that our people need. And our teachers are in a similar place where we're serving these dual purposes and these dual roles.
Right. I totally agree with you. I mean, yeah. And I didn't mean for you to speak on the criminal justice side, I guess, but you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm looking at the education side and on the criminal justice side, and you're right. They were both developed with the same pretenses. I mean, they were justified to serve, you know, when the criminal justice system was enacted, I mean, you know, African-Americans were looked as third-rate citizens, you know, minorities, you know, from, you know, different nationalities and stuff were looked as third-rate citizens. And we've never really moved forward. I mean, and you can see that all across the criminal justice system, to the way we police, to the way we, you know, to the laws, to the imprisonment rates and all of that. So, you know, and you're right, there hasn't been a lot of modifications to it. And you said something that was very powerful, you know, is who is our target audience? And here's the strange thing is that, you know, I've been saying this for years in the criminal justice side, and now it can be said for the educational side, is that we all need to stop looking at people as a label or as a color or as, you know, looking at, we need to look at each other as human beings with the common interest and the common goal in mind, and that is for everyone to become successful. So what do you think needs to change in the educational system to reach that goal, and how are we going to get it there? And you kept mentioning politicians. And, you know, politicians, unfortunately, and even in the law enforcement world, I mean, there's some police chiefs who will, well, that's a different story. There's politicians who will say what they need to say to get elected and only serve those that they can get a benefit out of. So how are we going to put the education system on track to where it's no longer self-serving of a certain color, but inclusive to all to become successful?
I do think that there's a piece, man, okay, this is a big question. I'm gonna give you a big answer.
Yes,
please. And I think there's also a lot of nuance to it. So I don't want this to seem like an oversimplification.
Right.
I think a big piece that I want to just name and address is we have to start talking about it. We have to get into dialogue and engage in listening to one another. You brought up this idea of seeing the humanity of different folks. And I do think and the movement that is happening right now around equity versus equality, this idea of anti-racism that's happening, is like, we have to be able to talk about that experience and the way our experiences are different. The way, like what you were surfacing around the criminal justice system having different impacts based on your socioeconomic background, your racial background. And it's the same thing in classrooms, right? We have to set up environments where our kids can talk genuinely and openly about the strength of their lived experiences. And right now, that's not necessarily the way that things are set up. I think there, again, a very complex answer, but there are a lot of standards inside of education that are open to interpretation, but we're still going back to some of these like classic ideas. There's competing philosophies in education around, do we have to build a core foundation of knowledge? You know, my mother still argues for every person should be able to do the mental math of all of the multiplication in their heads. And then young people are like, but I'm always going to have my phone on me. Why would I need to do multiplication? Yeah. And so it really is that reevaluation of what is the purpose? Who is the kind of individual and generation that we want to be raising through our system? And I think engaging in that dialogue, addressing the competing concerns of individuals in order to reimagine and to reinvent what we are doing inside of our classroom spaces. I don't see that happening necessarily anywhere right now, but there's potential there. Go ahead.
No, you're right. I mean, there's no way we're going to solve this problem in 45 minutes or 30 minutes, the 30-minute conversation. And this is a very deeply rooted conversation that would need to take place. But, you know, what do you think about, so, you know, right now, like I said, you know, we were talking about adversity and leading through it and this and that. And these are all conversations that a lot of leaders are refusing to take up to actually admit that our 350-year educational system was actually designed with a lot of flaws. And right now, I mean, what do you think about the current argument between traditional education, online education, to formal education, to no, we need a trade education, technical education, the difference between a degree And now Google has just thrown out, certifications, Google certifications. And they've got over, I think, something like 30,000 companies right now that are willing to accept a Google certification. So, I mean, what are your feelings towards all those different types of certifications, learning methods, and stuff?
Yeah, I think choice is important. I think the capacity for youth to understand themselves as learners and to select a method of learning that works best for them, and that might be digital or hybrid. With COVID-19, right? Like every teacher that's in the field right now has built a skill set around hybrid teaching that there's the potential to grow moving forward. And for some youth, they've thrived. I had young people who really struggled to sit in the classroom for extended periods of time. The flexibility of their day, their ability to self-pace, they are doing so well with this digital model. And then we had kids that we saw the opposite with, where they really need that structure and that guidance. And so it's provided us with more opportunities. And I think in terms of the long-term elements of what you're talking about with degrees and certifications and trade school programs, the work field is changing, right? We're not in a world anymore where you work the same job for 30 years. Most of our young people will work at least four careers before retirement. And so the capacity to pursue these certifications or to go to trade school, to me, it's more about understanding your options and being able to navigate those systems. Young people these days also talk about YouTube University, right? And like you could go on YouTube and essentially build your own degree without paying the $90,000 and having that kind of debt. But then also updating our business practices so that we recognize those as valid training methods is going to be the next step. So.
I mean, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I wish that before, and I'm glad that you went on a conservative number of 90,000 because, my PhD and my other degrees, it's way, way north of that. And I wish that I knew about YouTube University before I had acquired all that, because I'll be honest with you, every time I can't figure out how to do something, the first thing I do is, oh, YouTube's got a tutorial on that. I've learned more practical life less techniques or whatever you want to call them from YouTube than from any formal education that I've ever had.
That's
You know,
exactly. Yeah.
and you're right. We have refused to change with the times. And it's funny because you said something else that reminded me of a conversation I was having with somebody a couple of days ago about how traditional the workforce no longer are people working towards a retirement. People are working towards becoming self-made millionaires or billionaires or whatever. You know, our gen well, my generation at least, our goal was always to find a company you were going to work for, stay there 20, 25, 30 years, retire, then move on. And the conversation I was having is that when I finally realized that that wasn't right, and I only realized that after I had retired from my first 20-year career. And I went to my second police chief position. People were shocked because I went to a fairly small community of 30,000 people, and after my second year, I was looking to leave there to a bigger area, bigger department, and everybody was insulted, and I caught a lot of flack for it because everyone was like, "What do you mean you don't want to be here in this community for the next 20 years? Everybody, the last chief was here 27 years and the city manager was here." And it's like, well, and people were actually offended by that, but it's because the mentality of that small community hadn't changed. I
Yes.
mean, you look at it now, I mean, I've got my 22-year-old son has changed career paths 5 times already. And he's
Yeah.
22 years old.
Absolutely. My nephew's in a similar space, similar age, and is still at 23, just kind of figuring out what he wants to do with his life. Whereas past generations, right? Like my parents didn't have that option. Even I, didn't necessarily have that option of going back to school or kind of figuring things out as we go. But we live in a place where there's so much more access to information. And the workforce is changing, and youth are changing. Definitely not my area of specialties, but being in HR, we talk about it a little bit around the millennial generation and the hiring process and what that looks like and how it's different. Because to your point, right, this idea of self-made millionaires, but the other piece is the generation that's coming up, they want a mission, right? They want to change the world. They want to do things that are driven towards greater good, and they want to work for companies that are working towards that. And if they aren't seeing it, they want to build it and they want to create it. And that's very different value systems for sure.
So I want to change directions here, and I want to let people get to know you a little bit. So I got a couple of questions I want to ask you, and this helps our audience learn a little bit about you. But day or night person?
I am definitely a morning person. I am the kid that it was 9 p.m. and I was zonked out. Like, it didn't matter where I was.
that reminds me of my wife, and it's funny because, you know, while I'm awake, I usually wake up about 5 or 5:30 in the morning, but my brain doesn't start functioning till about 2 in the afternoon. And then I don't go to bed till about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. So sometimes I'm literally running on anywhere between 3 to 4 hours of sleep. Okay. That's when I function the best.
Yeah.
You know, if I get more than 6 hours of sleep, I am a blabbering idiot for the rest of the day. You know, so pineapple, does it belong on pizza? Yes or no?
I definitely, yes. In our house, pineapple is always on pizza.
That's what I say. I've had people who have actually shouted at me for having pineapple on pizza.
Yeah, my family's from the East Coast, from New Jersey, and I get grief all the time about our pineapple on pizza.
dark white or milk chocolate?
I'll go with dark chocolate today, but I've go back and forth a little bit.
You know, I think I am the only one out of the 13 other interviews that I have done and asked questions that I'm the only one who's ever said white chocolate.
Yeah. My partner loves white chocolate, but they can't eat regular chocolate. Something about the chemical makeup of it, I don't really understand. So,
well, you know, I don't like dark chocolate. I like milk chocolate, but I really enjoy white chocolate the best.
That is interesting.
And thanks to Kit Kat for making a white chocolate.
The white Reese's that have been out, those have been flying off the shelves and into our home for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And dog or cat person?
Dogs.
Yes. Yep. Dogs rule. Awesome. So, you know, I was reading your bio, and we had a conversation prior to that, and you talked about, I think you were in the classroom for, was it 8 years or was it 5 years?
I've been in the classroom for 7 years. Yeah.
7 years. Okay. 7 years. And then you started to feel a burnout. And yeah. A lot of leaders will fight through that burnout, not realizing that they're causing more damage to not only themselves, but to the entire organization and everybody that they serve. So how did you become aware of the burnout? When what triggered in your head to say, you know what, this isn't functioning anymore for me?
Yeah. I would say it was not a head decision. It was very much my physical body was just done. I was working at a school that was going through the process of being a turnaround or closing. And I had been just so invested in the community and what I was doing with youth and the mission of the school. And what happened was, it was a small charter. They decided to not renew. And it was just devastating. It was the carpet just pulled out from under me, the whole world just crashing down around me. I also at the same time had things going on in my personal life that just, I could not function. There was a point we didn't get subs. And so I refused to call in. So I showed up every day and I was working these 12-hour days in this extended day program. And I was sleeping under my desk. I would teach my class and then I'd sleep under my desk while another teacher taught art in my room. And the kids would come over and just check on me and be like, hey, why are you still here? Like, you need to go home. But I knew if I went home that somebody else would have to teach my classes. And everybody else was also just so stressed out at that time. And so there was no getting around it at that point. There was, it was like, you hit the wall, you just really can't go on anymore. And I had a big questioning of self and mission and what I had invested in the school's identity and how the school's identity had become my identity. And I had to take a step back from education. I thought I was going to leave altogether. And I think a lot of our teachers are experiencing that this year, going through all of the transitions of COVID. A lot of our teachers that have had 3+ different methods of teaching this past year. And they've had these competing priorities as they've been live broadcast into families' homes and had not just youth sitting in front of them, but also parents and parents with their different lenses. And I think that they're going through that same idea of questioning, right? What are our values in education? Who is the person that I am here to be and to serve and to support? And I'm hoping that we will not see a mass exodus of teachers that are coming through this with such incredible experience. Because I know from sticking through that for myself, it just made me such a more powerful educator. My vision of what was right, my vision of what I needed to succeed, but also the boundaries that I needed to set with youth really made a difference.
So I like something that you said, because I can relate totally to it 100%. There was a time in my life where, you know, I hit a complete burnout point, and I didn't know I was burnt out. I just thought I had way too many things going on and I was just tired. And like, you know, my body changed. I gained, I got to the heaviest I had ever been, and I'm still feeling the consequences of that. You know, it's been several years, and I'm barely starting to take off the weight that should be coming off. You know, I still got about another 25 pounds to go. But, you know, a year ago, you know, I don't think my face would have fit on the screen. So it is physical. I mean, you know, I remember carrying the stress on my shoulders to the point where I couldn't even lift. I mean, I couldn't even lift my arms. I literally had to do, you know, like, because it was so much tension and stuff. So I could definitely see that. So when your body reacted to that burnout, what did you do to recharge your batteries or reignite that imagination that led you to where you're at today?
Yeah, I think you talked about, you know, how a lot of leaders push through to a certain degree, right? Teachers have cycles in their years. And so I was like, I just got to finish this year. And I did push through to finish and to make sure that youth had the support that they needed, that they had me every day in their space. And I don't know if that was what was right or what's best. I don't think I set up the kind of model that I would like our young people to have in understanding themselves, but that's one reflection. I did a lot of self-exploration. I ended up doing several years of soul searching and just deep dive. Counseling was one of the big things that I took away, just taking care of my own mental health and my own state of being. And then it, you know, it's been almost 5 years since I had that experience. And I still continue a lot of those practices through self-reflection on daily and weekly basis, understanding and seeing some of those earmarks of behaviors that I have that I know that I'll push myself to that perfection or carrying all of the weight of the world on my shoulders and like being able to take that step back. And it's still a push and a pull because I think, Eddie, it sounds like you and I are very similar in just that like so driven in this purpose work, right? That you can't take that step back because you know what it means to show up every day and to do it.
You know, yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. I liked something that I also saw in your bio where you talked about learning from your mistakes. Care to share, like what are some of those mistakes that you how did you learn from those mistakes and turn them into a success? I mean, because I've always said that, you know, failure and mistakes are nothing but opportunity, and failure is the mother of all success. So how did you... if you don't mind sharing a few of them, and how did you learn from them?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, you know, as an educational equity coach, right, this like title that I have, a big piece of that has been the teacher, right? The teacher in me is just, I've failed more times than anybody else, than other folks have like attempted. And I've taken the opportunity to learn. And I also, I love the framing that you gave. And I think when we fail, we tend to learn more. Oftentimes when things come easy for us, then we can, it's actually really challenging. And so in educational equity, right, I had a very white growing up experience, right? People identify me as white. My ethnic background is Jewish and multi-generational European. And I had a lot of bias. I think that I deeply became an educator in a Title I school with that idea of saving folks. And, you know, even in the way I told my story today, right, I wanted to give something to other people that I didn't have. And that came across in my interactions with youth and my inability to see them authentically for who they were and the strengths and the gifts of what they were going through. And as I unpacked my own experiences to see how the adversity, right, the learnings that I'd had, the fact that I had been challenged was actually a gift, right? It was actually what I gained understanding of self and the capacity to show up authentically in the world that I was able to cultivate that space for youth as well. And because I think in a lot of our Title I schools, right, this term I'm using, but that impacts socioeconomic status. And typically we see higher rates of young people with disabilities as well as racial diversity. And that means that you've had a life experience that you multi-generational impact on what you're experiencing day to day. And a lot of our teachers come in with this mindset of like, education will set you free. And I was very much in that space. Specific examples, I think of one young man in my first year of teaching. He had an IEP, but it wasn't written very well. And my school had a program where we assigned a lot of homework. And he really struggled with that. And so him and I would stay at school until 9 o'clock at night to do homework together. And you could say that like, that's a very supportive practice, but I just think about the strain that was on him. I think about the pressure and how the only part of what I could see of was who he was as an academic and in the classroom. And I wasn't seeing who he was as a human being. I did not reach into understanding his family experience. I didn't think about how can I set him up with the tools and the skills to be doing these things outside of the classroom. And I deeply feel like I failed him because he started to hate school. He didn't want to come in the morning because we were spending so long and he was getting so much pressure to perform, but I also wasn't supporting him well, so.
Interesting. So shifting gears here a little bit. So country or city?
Oh, goodness. So Denver is like the cow town that thinks it's a big city, but recently has grown. And we've got this like new feel because of the influx of all of the people. And so I don't know, there's just something special about Denver. I don't know if I can pick because it's both all mixed together.
Awesome. You know, I will take the sounds and excitement of the concrete jungle city life any day over country life. Now, don't get me wrong. It's nice to spend some time in the country, but I'm a city boy and I love that concrete jungle. So,
that's fair. I love the pace of the country for sure.
Okay. How about, so beach life or lake life? Because there is a difference. Lakes.
Yeah, lakes. Definitely lakes. Mm. I've never been awesome. On beaches. Awesome. You're close to the beach, aren't you down there?
No. I live in El Paso. I mean, certain parts of Texas are on the beach. I live in El Paso, so we're in far west.
Okay.
My favorite beaches, you know, I did my honeymoon in Hawaii, and that was really awesome 18, 19 years ago. Yeah. I'm glad my wife's not here because she'd throw something at me if I got that wrong. but the beaches in Mexico are just amazing, you know. And being Hispanic, you know, I felt a connection when I went down to Mexico that I've never felt before. And now my goal is in the next 10 years to actually retire and be able to buy a house on the beach in Mexico somewhere. But anyway, those are my plans. And, you know, they always said that if you're a believer in God and you want to make him laugh, tell him your plans and he'll have a great laugh at it. But anyway, Ash, it's been wonderful having you here. Is there anything that you would like to leave us with actually, there's going to be two things. Is there anything that you'd like to promote? Do you have anything that you'd like to promote for yourself, your business, anything?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am putting together one-on-one coaching as I am developing. So the coaching I was talking about that I'm putting together with schools, I'm opening that up as an opportunity for other organizations, that small to mid-sized org. A lot of our industries are realizing they want to hire somebody for diversity, equity, and inclusion, but they don't necessarily have the funds. And so it is about cultivating capacity on the team you already have. So if you're interested in that, you can check me out at liberatedbydesign.org. And for teachers, I'm putting together a cohort of learning so that people can connect across the country to really center equity for their youth and in their classrooms.
Awesome. So, how do we get a hold of you?
My website is liberatedbydesign.org, and you can also email me at ash@liberatedbydesign.org.
Liberatedbydesign.org. Awesome. Again, I'm definitely anybody that's interested, head that way. Now, the other thing I want to ask is any final words of wisdom, encouragement, nuggets of knowledge that you would like to leave our audience with?
You were putting me on the spot here, right? Be wise in 30 seconds or less. Go.
Exactly. You got more than 30 seconds.
I do think that I would love for folks to understand the power of where they are and their capacity to create change. We talk a lot about waiting for a policy or a law or justice to be sought in some way that's external to us. And I don't think that we oftentimes take the moment to appreciate the impact that we can have just by listening to the people that are around us, by engaging in dialogue and really hearing the people that are in front of us and the way that that can transform individuals and then the way that that translates into some really long-term and generational change and impact.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. And before I let you go, one last question. Is there a difference between listening and hearing, and what is it?
Absolutely. Listening is very much being present with somebody, right? Like you are with me now. You're sitting. I can tell that you are engaging in what I am trying to communicate and trying to draw that out for me, as opposed to thinking, right? Hearing and just like thinking about what are you going to say next? How am I going to respond? What's the clever story that I can add on or the way that I can find connection? Instead, I want to like lean into learning from the person that's sitting in front of me, which I deeply appreciate, Eddie. You're doing a great job at
Awesome. Well, Ash, it's been great having you here, and I look forward to hopefully having you back on the show at some point, and we can find out the advancements that you've made and anything. But again, one last opportunity. Any final words you'd like to just close out with?
No, just thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. All right, there you go. Wonderful guest, an educator, a thought provocative, a person of vision. And God, I love people of vision. Can't stand short-sightedness. Anyway, there you go. Another episode in the books. And as I always say, and I don't mean anything negative by it, but anybody who knows me, you know what I mean when I say, don't let the same snake bite you twice. We'll see you next time. All right.